Okay, the doors are closed. It must be time to start. I am Courtney Perry. I will be talking about copyright law today. Just kind of some basic 101, what it is, what it isn't. I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of the basic law and some of the other forms of intellectual property, just kind of to compare and contrast it. But so we're going to start with that. I'm going to give you a little bit of my spiel, and then I'll open up for questions, because I'm sure that each of you have some particular interests that if I talk for an hour, hour and a half, till Scott kicks me out, I might hit on what you want and I might not. So a little bit of organized spiel, organized being a relative term, and then a little bit of open for Q&A. First, basic stuff. I'm Courtney Perry. I'm a practicing attorney. I also teach as an adjunct at Emory Law School. My legal practice is corporate and intellectual property, so I don't do litigation. So sometimes I make snarky comments about the litigators. I'm not one of them. That's why I make the snarky comments about them. You always make the snarky comments about someone else, and the litigators are the other. In the legal world, there are basically two kinds of lawyers. There are the corporate folks, and there's the litigators. And we get along and stuff, but we don't really like them. But anyway, so my background in copyright comes from both the academic standpoint and from working with a bunch of different authors and artists and folks like that, some of whom are wonderful professional humans and others are artists. But you learn some interesting things. So let me start just by basically telling you the three main forms of traditional intellectual property, and there's a fourth that I'll touch on as well. Trademark, copyright, patent, and trade secret is the fourth one. Trade secret is kind of the squishy one. Copyright is what we're talking about, so I'm going to get to it last. Trademark is the one that people often confuse with copyright. Trademark is, usually I have Coke products, I teach at Emory. Today I have the Evil Empire product. Mountain Dew, there's your trademark. It's the name of your product, it's whatever their slogan, all the caffeine, woohoo, wake up, whatever their slogan is this week. That's the trademarked part. The logo, how it appears, you can even do the trade dress, the particular color of nuclear green bottle, perhaps, probably not. But what the product looks like, how you know this is the product you intended to buy. It's not the substance of your book. It's not your copyright. It's not your code for your computer program. This is the name of your company, your slogan, and what your product looks like. That's trademark. Trademark is actually an interesting area, at least to me. I'm kind of a law geek. Trademark is not about protecting Mountain Dew's right to call themselves Mountain Dew. It's about protecting you, the consumer, from someone else who might palm off some green product and call it something similar that looks like Mountain Dew, but doesn't have the life-giving caffeine source, which is why we drink this green crap in the first place. So, it's a Consumer Protection Act. It really is intended, so when you buy something off the shelf, you're getting what you think you're getting. If you buy a red can with a white swoosh, you know what's in it. You don't have to look real closely and make sure. For the record, if you ever are thinking of doing some sort of pirated good or even a parodied sort of good or anything, don't take on the Big Red Tower. They have some of the meanest trademark attorneys in the world. They will find you and they will kill you. Even just funny little t-shirts with the red shirt and the white swoosh that says something else, yeah, they'll get you. And they will shut you down. And it won't be pretty. We used to say that it would actually, that the ultimate cage match would not be, ooh, who'd win, Batman or Superman? No, it would be the Disney trademark lawyers and the Coca-Cola trademark lawyers. And we don't know who would win, but they may be left standing, the world around them would be smoking desolation. We're not certain. But anyway, so that's trademark. And so if you have a company name, if you're doing computer work and you have a particular piece, a name for your software product, that's trademarked. Trademark you can do without a lawyer, but you will hate it. Lawyers tend to be too expensive to do trademark filing for you, though, if you're a small company or an individual. The trademark filing is not hard, but it's a pain in the ass. Until you get the hang of how to do it, it's just annoying, but it really is not hard. If you felt the need to trademark something yourself and didn't want to shell out the big bucks to a trademark lawyer, that's a process you could do. You go to USPTO.gov, it's the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office's website. There's some fairly easy system to go through it. You can do the whole thing online. And the nice thing about it is if you don't tell, there are two options now. One of which is the abbreviated, I'm certain I have it right process, and it'll save you $50. The other one is the here's my best guess, please help me process. If any of y'all decide to go register your own trademark, do the here's my best guess, please help me process. I do that. I mean, I'm a trademark lawyer, for pity's sake. I always do that one, partially because my client's money I'm spending on the extra $50, and partially because whenever you have a government official official being an overstatement, a government employee overseeing your application, deciding whether it's good enough and whether it complies, whether it goes through, they will find ways to pick it apart just because it's their job and they feel better and more powerful if they do. So no matter how perfect your trademark application is, they will find something wrong. You called that light blue, it's medium blue. Rejected. So you pay the extra $50, you get the full scrutiny, and they'll say, oh, they'll send you back a very official looking letter saying that, oh, you have to fix this, humma, 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 humma. It's a fine medium blue, move on, and you're good. But anyway, if you needed to do a trademark filing, it is possible as a human, pay the extra $50 and do the full filing so that the trademark examiners can call you and tell you what you need to do to fix it rather than just rejecting it because you didn't read their minds in advance. And like I said, since it varies from one to the other, I had one client that was registering a bunch of trademarks for them, and I hate doing that. It's paralegal work, but you know, your clients need it, so you do it. I'm not the firm anymore. I can't haul it off to the paralegal and say, okay, go do this now. But we were doing several different products that were, it was all software products. It was stuff they're selling on the web, and there is no physical, tangible product. The trademark office, like most of the government, lags a long time behind the rest of the world. There was a time when it was very exciting filing trademarks because they had gotten to the point where they would only accept online filings, but as part of your filing, you have to file a picture of the mark as it's used and a picture and an example of the product that's used in commerce. And they had no way to accept any sort of digital images. It's like, so I can't file a paper filing. No, we don't accept those any longer. How do I, everything you're telling me about the images is still in terms of 8x12 paper. They said, oh, well, you can attach a digital image. I'm like, how? And they, if you ask nicely, they'd tell you the way that wasn't marked on the website. And they said that, you know, keep trying it until it gets a size the computer will accept. So I did. And eventually you could get, they've gotten much better than that, but you still have the human factor. I was doing the same sort of project over and over. Some of it was ringtone, some of it was other stuff. But it was, one would accept a screenshot from the website as an example of the mark as it's used in commerce. One of them wouldn't. One of them still said, I need a picture of a box. I'm like, there is no box. The product is intangible. There is no box. But she wouldn't accept that. There had to be a label or a something that we could use. I'm like, no, there's no. So we mocked up a picture of a box, and she thought it was a box, and so she accepted the picture, and we moved along. I hope that's not malpractice, something I'm admitting to.
No, but that's common practice. There's a lot of software these days where they mock up a virtual box that looks like you would pick it up on the shelf, but they don't actually sell any box. So it's become common.
The reason they may do that is because somewhere their trademark lawyer made them mock up the damn box. They could get it through the trademark application. Yeah.
Why couldn't you take a picture of like a splash screen on a computer monitor or something?
Not good enough. It was not the product.
Okay.
Yeah. We went around that one many times. Many times. And I advise the guys, I can't tell you to fake a box. However, if you were to send me a picture of a box that I suspected was not real, I wouldn't ask you. So we got a fake picture of a box and sent it, and that was fine. It's like, we're not lying. It's an honest to God product. This is how we use the mark, but anyway, that's trademark, which is not what I'm here to talk about, but many people ask us about copywriting their name or copywriting their slogan. If it's a name or a slogan or a logo, if it identifies your company, your product, your services, your goods, then it is going to be trademarked, not copyrighted. The good news there is trademarks never expire. As long as you use the identifier for your company or for your product, it goes on forever and ever. Every 10 years or so, you have to give them a little more money, but eventually it even goes past that point. It just, as long as you use the mark, it goes on forever.
You have to defend them too, right?
Sporadically, but after a certain point, they don't care as much. Now, trademarks get interesting in terms of the defense. The one way you can lose your trademark, even after it becomes presumed to be valid and it becomes unchallengeable in theory, is what happened to products like refrigerator, aspirin, and things like that, and cola, where it used to be part of someone's proprietary name, it fell into common usage as a generic. If people start referring to a caramel-colored fizzy soda as cola, then the company that invented Coca-Cola will lose cola out of their name. That's one of the reasons that Coke lawyers are so rabid, is because they already lost half their name. Because if it falls into the generic usage, and that's usage by the populace, so good luck controlling that. But if it falls into generic usage, then your name no longer defines your product, your product, it defines the good. Cola, to us now, defines the generic cola drink. Originally, that was a that was defined as part of Coca-Cola's name, and they lost that part of the name. Refrigerator was a brand name. Now it means that big thing we have in our kitchen that keeps our food from rotting. But originally, that was a brand name. Aspirin as well. Aspirin was originally a brand name for Bayer, and they lost that. That's why you see strange things on ads sometimes, M&M brand candy, because M&M's doesn't want Hershey. No, that's Mars, isn't it? Mars doesn't want M&M's to become generic for candy-coated chocolate pellets. So it's M&M brand candy. You often see strange things, Band-Aid brand adhesive bandage. And you're like, why are you saying that? That's so awkwardly phrased. But again, oh God, I cut myself. Do you have a Band-Aid? Am I asking you for a brand or for that sticky thing so I don't bleed all over the floor and make people nervous while I'm talking? Well, if it becomes generic in the use of Band-Aid, the Band-Aid company loses their name. Because again, trademark is meant to protect you guys, not enrich the company for their name. You, a lot of y'all probably have seen, in because Xerox still does it. There was a time when Xerox was the only people making copiers. And at least some of y'all look like you're grown up enough that you remember that time. So Xerox still does put ads in the Wall Street Journal and other big trade publications saying, please stop saying, I'm going to go Xerox something. Please say, I'm going to go make copies on our Xerox machine. And now the vernacular does seem to have changed to, I'm going to go copy this, I'm going to make copies, which is interesting from a copyright panel, I suppose. But with original usage, everyone in office would say, oh, go Xerox this for me. It became a verb. When the name becomes a verb, it's on its way to generic. So Xerox really spent a lot of money running full-page ads saying, please stop that. Don't say that anymore. Go say copy it, but use our machines. So, yeah.
If Coke has this huge, you know, rabid group of people that are doing this, and I can still walk into a movie theater and order a large popcorn and a large Coke, and she asks me which thing I want, you know, do I want Coke or Cherry Coke or Diet Coke?
That's not as bad because it's just a breed of Coke. Those are all Coke products. That's okay.
Right, but I mean, I'm ordering a large Coke, and
yeah.
She doesn't
Which
know
Coke
what
do
that.
You want?
I just ordered a Coke, and
yeah.
So is it really even doing any good? I mean, isn't it just a coincidence that people stop saying Xerox?
For Xerox, I believe so. When they lost some of their market share, people started just using the phrase copying. But some people actually tried to do that, and just Xerox showing that they had made that effort helped them defend the mark. The other thing with Coke is, you will find that if you walk into a store and ask for a Coke, if they hand you, oh, by the way, just in case any of y'all care, if you go into a store or a restaurant or anywhere, if you order a Coke and they bring you a Pepsi, call the Big Red Tower, they'll send you coupons for free Cokes. You gotta rat out whoever did that to you because that violates the trademark. If you order a Coke and they give you a Pepsi, someone in the Big Red Tower is doing this because they can smell it having happened. If you'll call them and tell them, call the main number, tell them what happened, they will direct you exactly to the right person. Someone's job is to take these phone calls. They will send someone in a very serious blue suit out to that restaurant. And they'll send you a couple coupons for free six packs. It used to be a case, they've had some cutbacks over at the Big Red Tower, but they'll still send you a couple coupons for free six packs. Because if you, and that one especially, it's kind of a religious thing. Coke, Pepsi, you know. I teach at Emory, but, you know, I can't take this product into Emory. I have to drink approved caffeine sources while I'm teaching at Emory. Emory is run by Coca-Cola, pretty much. All the funding comes from the Woodruff Foundation. The founders were big Coke. It's Atlanta. Everything here is Coke. But anyway, so what people also have in the Midwest usage is, I want a Coke, and by Coke, they just mean soda. And they may mean a Sprite or an orange soda is a
right.
Coke.
That's what I'm talking about.
That way in Texas.
And so that's kind of a regional usage, which Coke has been trying to stomp out. And you can't completely change how people talk, but you can try. If you're a lawyer, you'll make an effort.
You'll get me to make an effort.
Yeah.
How long does that usage have to go through? Like the populace uses that as a verb.
There's not an answer to that because you don't lose your trademark till you sue someone for infringement and you lose. Mm-hmm. Because basically you'll say, hey, you used my trademark, cut it out. And the person, if they actually have enough lawyers to fight you back, will say, oh yeah, it's generic. I can too use it. And that's when they would lose the mark. The trademark office won't pronounce something as dead. That's much too proactive. They don't do that. They just issue the trademarks and wait until someone fusses about it.
So they don't even want to sue because they might lose.
Oh, no. Coke will win.
But it only takes one case, right?
Yeah, but as long as you do your mark maintenance and you take care of your mark and you're using it and you're doing, and even just showing, like Xerox did, that they're trying to protect the mark and trying to protect it from falling into the vernacular, that goes a long way, and the judge will see that they took reasonable steps, and most likely they won't. Most of the famous marks that were lost, I mean, the reason that I'm using examples like cola and refrigerator and aspirin is because most of them were lost at the dawn of time. So, right, so our lawyers have gotten better, and they've learned, oh, crap, that's how the system works? Well, we won't let that happen anymore, and it usually does not now.
Is that why laptop and was it notebook? Like, the commercial outlets that sell them call them notebooks, but everybody I know calls them laptop computers because they're...
I don't know if either of those was ever actually proprietary.
I don't know anybody that says notebook computer at all.
And I think that was originally distinguished because the original laptops were actually bigger. I owned a laptop that was, you know, like this thick. It was smaller than a desktop, which was then the size of a desk. But, you know, the laptop was like this. Mm-hmm. And then they came out with the notebooks that were just what we now call laptops because they were the skinnier, they were the size of a notebook. So I don't think that was ever a brand name. I think that was just a descriptor of saying, look, it's like a laptop, but you don't need, you know, three people to carry it for you. Okay, so that's trademark, which, not saying the fact I've talked about it for quite some time, is what we're not talking about today. Patent is something else that we're not talking about today. Patent is one that, no, you can't do it yourself, just for the record. I can't do it for you either. I'm not a patent lawyer. Patent lawyers are a strange breed of human who can do both science and law. There aren't many. Most people who have scientific or engineering-style brains go to law school, their heads explode, and they leave. Just like most lawyers, there's a reason we're lawyers, not doctors, it's because we can't do math and science. That's kind of a lawyer joke, but as I mentioned yesterday, I think a couple of you are here for that. There actually are only three lawyer jokes. The rest are true stories. One of the favorite lawyer jokes amongst law students especially, some of them don't get some of the others because they haven't been out of practice yet, but they all get this one, which is, you know, and of course y'all would be doctor, you would be in med school if you could do the math and science, and it's true for most of them. So, yeah, that's where lawyers go. But there is this strange subset of human who can do both the hard science and the law. They become patent lawyers, and they make a lot of money because there just aren't many of them. And in order to sit for the patent bar, and by the way, if you ever are going to hire a patent lawyer, here's your practice pointer for the month. Ask them if they are a member of the patent bar. If they are not, do not hire them. Period. I could walk you through a patent application, but I shouldn't because I'm not a patent lawyer. I'm not a member of the patent bar. There are things I'm allowed to do and things I'm not allowed to do. Patent law is one of the few specialties in law that you actually have to have a special credential to practice. I could hold myself out as a trust and estate lawyer. I could write wills for all of you guys. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it because I've never done one in my life. I hired a lawyer to do mine because it's just not my specialty. But I could hold myself out and start writing wills. I'd suck, but I could do it. Patent law, I am by law forbidden to do so. But I would be allowed to help you file a patent application. That's one of the things that's not carved out into the monopoly of patent lawyers. But for the love of God, don't hire someone who's not a patent lawyer to do your patent. You're just wasting your money because they're not going to be able to do it well. So patent lawyers, ask if they're a member of the patent bar. And you will need one to file a patent. Patents apply to inventions. They apply to a lot of things that they shouldn't apply to. But in a perfect world, patents apply to inventions, innovations, and machines. Stuff that does things. Stuff that is non-obvious. Patents give you a lot of rights to exclude others from using the idea of how to do this. You have very broad rights under a patent. They last, you know, some combination of 11, 17, 20 years, depending on how it's filed. And they are very expensive to file. They take a long time to get, but they give you a lot of very strong rights. But they are supposed to be for machineries, for processes. A car is patented. The colors and the design of it, those might be copyrighted. But patents are machines. They're the science stuff. They're the biotech stuff. They're the new way to make ethanol. Those things are patented. Now, the patent office, as we discussed a little bit yesterday, is smoking something really good because they have become very irrational of late. They are issuing patents on stuff that boggles the mind. So when I tell you, for instance, that patents do not apply to things that exist in nature, that it has to be an invention, not a discovery. If I discovered gravity, a little late in life, I can't patent gravity. Well, probably I could now. The patent office has lost all touch with the mothership, and they're drifting out in space on their own. So if you came up with the idea of patenting something very basic, like I think the method of pedestrian ambulatory transportation involves a process in which one places the left foot forward, shifts the weight subtly forward, bending the foot, and then moves the right foot, you might be able to patent walking. And it would not surprise me if they would give that to you, because obviously no one's thought of that before. The patent office is smoking crack. But that's what it's supposed to be for. Process is a better mousetrap. That's patents. It should also be software, but that's a different thing, too. It's not. Some software is subject to patents. Ones that are actual algorithms can be patented, and it is patents are, except for the fact that they've gone insane, a much better match academically and intellectually for software than is copyright. Copyright, however, is where most software is protected. So now having, oh, trade secret is the one other thing. Trade secret is something that if you have a secret process or a secret recipe, you know, the Colonel's 11 herbs and spices, Coca-Cola's secret product recipe, you can keep it secret by keeping it secret. So like, you know, if you have a secret that you don't want anyone to know, how do you make sure that no one knows your secret? Don't tell anyone. Yes, exactly. It's amazing to have my friends tell me something that has to be a big secret. I'm like, it's supposed to be a big secret. Why are you telling me? I mean, you know that I don't tell shit. I'm a lawyer. I'm very good at keeping secrets. That's what I do. But when I hear the same secret from some of my gossip-prone friends, I'm like, I think you're using the word secret in a way that does not actually match the definition. Because even though it's all coming to me and stopping here, I don't have any delusion that I'm the only one you're telling. So, yeah, if you want to keep it a secret, if it's really good gossip, or you did something really, really bad but no one saw you, the way you keep that a secret is by not telling anyone. Trade secret's the same thing. If you, as a company, have a process, a recipe, something like that, that is secret, keep it secret, don't tell anyone. That's where you can have agreements with your employees that you're going to share the stuff with them, but they can't tell anyone. You can bind them by contract, keep their mouths shut, and then sue them when they don't. But that's Coke's secret recipe. It's the Colonel's 11 herbs and spices. Coke literally has the recipe in a vault in the Big Red Tower. Yeah?
If someone else were to discover the 11 herbs and spices independently of...
Then it's fine. You have the one thing about trade secret is as long as they did not steal it from you, and when you're using trade secret, you'll talk to your lawyer, and the lawyer will give you the outlines of things that you need to do. But basically, it's keep it secret. Don't tell anyone. Take reasonable steps to protect it. Then if someone breaks into your office with the intention of stealing your trade secret, you get the benefit of legal protection, and then they stole your trade secret. You did all the right things to keep it secret. They broke some laws getting to it. Therefore, you can keep them from using it. But if they independently discover it, they didn't steal it from you, so you have no recourse against them. Yeah.
Does that include reverse engineering?
Mm-hmm. You're allowed to reverse engineer something. The trade secret is really, you can't break into the vault and see Coke's trade secret. They actually threw a couple people in jail not long ago for selling the formula. One of the secretaries to one of the big corner office guys got her hands on it. Or so she thought. She didn't actually have the real one, by the way, because the real one literally is in a vault, never gets out. But she had what she thought was a real one and sold to someone at Pepsi. And Pepsi, to their credit, although we don't usually say nice things about them in Atlanta, notwithstanding the fact I'm clearly addicted to one of their frontline products, the Pepsi folks, when this chick contacted them, called the Big Red Tower and said, hey guys, you got a problem, here's her name, what do you want us to do? And so they and the FBI set up a nice big sting and nailed her. So they take it very seriously, and it's not just fooling around stuff. And that's trade secret, that's not trademark or anything else, that was trade secret, but the FBI came in on it. And she's currently residing in one of our fine barred windowed institutions. Her life is not as happy as it used to be. So trade secrets, you just have to keep them secret. You do have some protection, but if someone else discovers them, you can't keep them from using it. And people reverse engineer Coke all the time. And that's when they discover that, you know, I can give you the recipe for my favorite cake, and you may or may not end up with a cake if you don't know the order in which to put things in, how long to cook it, or, you know, the proportions in which to add them. The distinction between how much salt and how much flour when you're making cake is kind of important. And if you just have a list of ingredients and no clue how to do it. So Coke takes extraordinary measures also. Even when they send the syrup to the bottlers, the syrup changes every shipment. So how the bottlers dilute it, what they add to it, is going to change from time to time. So there's not even a standard formula for Coke's syrup. They are hardcore keeping their stuff secret. They have lots of lawyers. Okay. Patent, trademark, trade secret. That's what copyright is not. Copyright is mainly about arts and books and things and songs and music and films and things like that. It is also software. One of my pet peeves, which Scott is saying, yeah, she's going there again. Copyright really is not intended to apply to things that are practical and do stuff. Copyright's fun, artsy crap. Patent is the science stuff. Software is science stuff. It's not fun, artsy crap. When you write a cut piece of code, you're not choosing the words because you think they express your inborn ideas brilliantly. You're using those words because they're the ones that will make the machine do what you want it to do. I know it's artistic, I know it's creative, but the words you use are the words that will cause the effect that you want, not the ones that will most brilliantly express your inner novel. However, copyright copies expression. Software is expression, ergo, copyright covers software. It was actually done, I was going to steal Scott's project or paper over there. It was actually done by the first lawsuit where software became copyright before it became part of the Act, the Copyright Act itself, was a lawyer who worked with a guy I used to teach with, very brilliant litigator, who was trying to convince this judge that software should be covered by copyright law. This was before anyone really was into computers. They were not sitting on everyone's desks. They were things that were in Star Trek. And this judge, being a lawyer by trade, was farther behind the curve than the rest of the world and was listening to these guys talk about this stuff that at that point was on punch cards, not anything else, and going, huh? And the lawyer came in and pulled up literally this level of technology, but a bigger one, because we're lawyers, we like things big, and wrote scads of ones and zeros across it and said, that's what the code is. It's all ones and zeros. Doesn't matter what form it's in, this is what it actually is. The judge saw expression that he could understand, and that was good enough to be copyrighted. Then there were some congressional commissions, and it got added into the Copyright Act as well. But anyway, copyright is intended to protect your original expression. Notice I have not said idea. Copyright does not protect your idea at all, ever, under any circumstances. I had this great idea for a story. Boy meets girl, yeah, you can go from there. The idea of Romeo and Juliet obviously is fairly traditional. The idea of Star Wars is fairly traditional. The trappings and details of it, when it was done, were fairly unique. But the basic storyline, come on, y'all have read that book 100 times with different characters in different settings. The idea of that basic conflict and that basic coming of age stuff, no one can copyright those ideas or those themes. If I have a brilliant idea for a piece of artwork, if I want to put multicolored parasols across the Midwest, whatever Christos did last, that idea is not protected under copyright. When I fix that idea in a tangible form, then it's protected. When I write it down, when I put the paint on the wall, when I take the picture, then it's protected. And copyright, unlike trademark and patent, you do not actually have to file. As soon as you write down your idea, what you have written down is protected. Now again, what is protected is the expression, how you describe your idea, your exact words, your exact painting. The idea still is not protected. And that's why copyright, when you're talking about things like books and paintings, fits the original constitutional theory. The original constitutional theory was, hey, we want to promote the creation of arts and sciences. Our country will be better off if we have lots of artists and lots of scientists doing their stuff and putting it out there so that the marketplace of ideas will always be increasing. How do you incentivize people to create? Same way you incentivize them to do anything else. Okay, actually there are two ways, but the government couldn't figure out how to work sex into the equation, so they stuck with money. And so you are given a limited monopoly, limited in time, limited in, yeah, we'll talk about it later, limited in time and limited in scope over your expression, or in patents, over your invention. And patents do cover ideas to an extent. Patents are different. But so you're given by the government this monopoly. Notice that the government's granting this monopoly. If you're in Europe, and even if you just independently were thinking about it, you think about, I wrote this book, it's my property. Any of you heard Mad Max fans? The line that I've always loved, it's my snake, I trained it, and I'm going to eat it. So there's a sense of property. We all understand property from a playground aspect. If I walked up here and said, huh, okay, is this my book? What do you think?
No.
He's saying no. Now, if y'all were in my law school class, you might say, yes, please don't fail me. But in reality, you saw me go over and take this book. Is it mine? Hell no, it's not mine. It's his. You saw me take it. It's his. How do you know it's his?
Because he took it from him.
Because it was there with his stuff. And we all have an inherent feeling of, that's his stuff. It doesn't become your stuff just because you took it. So, obviously, it is not my book. Although, if I stood here long enough, some of you might forget.
What about this book?
Do you want me to take that one instead?
I was just in the dealer room. There's a big pile of these with sciences.
Oh,
take one, they're free.
God.
No, seriously.
So it's now your book. They gave away that piece of property. It's now your book. You can give books away in any number of ways. You can give stuff away in any number of ways. I can start giving away Scott's stuff if I want to, but you know, I bet he'd stop me because it's his stuff, not mine. He can give it away, but he ain't gonna. If I start trying to give away these tables, someone ought to stop me. If I try to sell these tables, someone ought to stop me. Because we all have an idea of, it's mine, it's yours. You shouldn't take my stuff, I shouldn't take your stuff. And we have that same instinctive idea of, I wrote this book. So the words on this page belong to me, and I may sell you copies of it, or I may license to you the rights to make a movie out of it, but I wrote this. So this work is mine. And we all kind of have that same instinctive feel about that. That is not how copyright law works. Copyright law is not based on property. We call it intellectual property, but it's not. It's not based on the same, this is mine, this is yours schematic that we all understand so well. It is based on the government wants to encourage, and government, I mean those guys with ponytails and tights, the founding fathers. They wanted to encourage the promote arts and sciences, so they said we're going to incentivize it by giving monopoly. So it is a government-given right, not God-given, government-given right, that you will have the monopoly on your book, on your invention, on your painting for a limited period of time and limited in scope and controlled by the government. Again, the goal here is to get people to create. Because if I write a book and I publish the book, I have a lot of rights in that book, but the ideas that I'm talking about, the cool things I've come up with, all those neat things that I'm expressing, those ideas are now out in the marketplace. And you can use those ideas and build on them. I'm sharing my thoughts. Some people's thoughts are more worthwhile than other people's thoughts, but all of them get out in the marketplace. Because if we give you the right to protect the work in that book of yours, you're going to sell that book. Or you may just publish that book for free on the internet. That was not what the Founding Fathers were talking about. This is a book written by Lawrence Lessig. It's called Free Culture. Go buy one. It's a great book. You can get this free downloaded off the internet. I printed out a long copy of it at one point. So this is stupid. I don't bought the books. It's a really good book. You can buy it from Penguin Press or Amazon, like everyone does. Or you can download it off the computer for free. But he owns the right to decide how this book is distributed. And he's chosen to do it a number of different ways. Okay, great. So he still owns these words. And this is one more distinction I'm going to draw, which is, again, lawyers spend a lot of time working on it, but you all understand it already. Do I own this collection of paper? And by the way, yes, I bought this copy of the book. I didn't steal this from someone in the front row. So assuming that I did, in fact, order this from Amazon like everyone else in the free world does, do I own this paper? Do I have any rights to what he's written?
No.
Well done.
Do I have any rights to what he's written? No, of course not. These are still his words. I'm allowed to own this copy of it. Now, were I so inclined, I could give Scott this copy. He has one, he doesn't need it. But I can give away my copy of this book. I can stomp up and down on it. I can burn it. There are a lot of things I can do to this book. Can I make copies of it?
No.
Of course not. That's copyright. And y'all understand the basics of that. I own the tangible copy. Professor Lessig still owns the words. So I can do whatever I want to this tangible copy, including resell it. He sold it once, I get to sell it once myself. So if I want to resell this book, that's perfectly legal and he does not get a cut of it. He got a cut the first time. He only got one bite of the apple in copyright. So he already sold it, I already bought it. Now I can do whatever I want with this tangible copy. What I cannot do is redistribute it, copy it. I can't make a new version of it, modify it, and then sell it, even if I give credit to him. He owns the words, I own the paper, and the cover binding and the blank pages on the inside. But you all understand that as well. Lawyers can spend days with that. I'll walk my students through the permutations of that for a week in class, but it's because we're lawyers and we don't understand things as well as normal humans. So, I own the book, he owns the words. Copyright, so he still owns the right to the expression, but you know what I can do? I can go through here and learn something that he wrote, and I can then take that fact that I learned or that idea that he expressed that I absorbed into my own brain, I can use that freely any way I want. I can't use the words that he used without his permission, but the stuff that he's saying, if I re-say it some different way and express my own stuff with it, I can write a book that I got the ideas from this. Who knows, maybe I will. Probably won't be as good as his, though.
But if it made a fraction of the money, I'd be a happy girl.
At any rate, I can take his ideas and work on them. If I were to find the original tomb of King Arthur, I did all of the original research, I learned how to read that strange old English stuff that we all tried to do in Beowulf, but their letters even looked different if you see the original text. I can go back and learn that crap. I speak German, so I'm halfway there. I can go back, learn the original old English, do all of the original research, I could find the tomb of King Arthur. If I found the tomb of King Arthur. And I found the place in Glastonbury Plains, wherever that is, that he actually laid. I found it, I paid some scientists to do the DNA testing, I found out indeed, wow, look, here's King Arthur. I published the book. Woot. I think I would get tenure based on that. But, so I have done this incredible discovery, I have pulled all these original old documents, I published that book, and it languishes on the shelves, because it turns out I'm a really crappy writer. I thought people would be interested, and they would have been if I could string three words together in an interesting fashion. My book sucks, but it's got great information in it. So some other guy, Stephen King, or Steven Spielberg, or one of those guys comes through and says, wow, this is really fascinating stuff. I'm going to take all of the facts out of this and write a book about it. Can I sue them for copyright infringement?
No.
They took facts out of my book, and facts are not protected. The ideas that I came up with, the part where I talk about Arthur and the space aliens, they can take that too. They can't take how I express it. And if my book were structured in a certain original way, and they made theirs structured in that same original way, yeah, they couldn't do that either. If I wrote my book in something like chronological order or something else, they could organize their book the same way. They can't steal my words. But all the stuff I said, they can have that very freely. That's one of the limits of copyright. It only protects the expression. Again, with the intention of getting that stuff out in the marketplace. When you get to art, it's a little harder but it's the same concept. My idea of drawing a big horse on a hotel wall, aside from the obvious hotel security coming in and dragging me out of here, I can draw a big horse. Do I have the right to keep other people from drawing big horses?
No.
No. What if I came up with a big horse with wings and it was white? Okay, so far not. There's at some point, though, where I'm going to come... Well, I wouldn't, if I were an artist and had original ideas. I could at some point come up with a detailed enough painting that if someone else made one just like it, it would look more like they were copying me than that they had come up with the same idea. At the point that they're copying my painting, they violated my copyright. If they had never seen my painting and came up with the same one, though, that's okay. Independent creation is not copyright violation. If I had lived in a cave and had never heard anything by Ricky Martin and came out and said, I suddenly feel this urge to compose music. I've never been a musician before, but apparently living in a cave for 10 years caused it to happen. And I come up with this really cool song, Livin' La Vida Loca, which is interesting because I didn't speak Spanish. But nevertheless, I come up with this cool song and I record it. Technically, I'm not violating Ricky Martin's copyright. Because I didn't hear his original song, so I didn't copy it. I independently created it. I'm allowed to do that. What are the odds of that happening, exactly? And that's where you get into the weird lawyer crap with copyright law. If a work is famous, it's almost impossible to convince a judge that you have independently created it. And independent creation was actually in large part, although it still is technically good law and is part of the copyright code, independent creation is kind of hard to prove because George Harrison lost a lawsuit. George Harrison wrote a song called My Sweet Lord. And when I teach the class, I think people listen to it because a lot of my students have never heard this before. Much less have they heard the song that he lost to. He must have had really bad lawyers. The Chiffon song, He's So Fine. A song called the Doolang Doolang Doolangs. Yeah. I have never heard the word doolang in George Harrison's song, by the way. Nevertheless, the Chiffons came up and said, hey, My Sweet Lord sounds an awful lot like He's So Fine. Well, first you go through the analysis of infringement. How close is it? Does it really sound the same? How much the same does it sound? And I could spec out for you the exact steps of an infringement analysis, and I make my law students learn it because lawyers have to know those things. The reality is the judge then sits there and looks at you and goes, eh, kind of alike, not really alike. Yeah, not really alike. And that's the verdict. Because there's no real way to give a good categorization legal, we actually have lots of good legal terms we bandy around when we make these decisions, but the bottom line is, how close is it? Does it look like they copied it, or does it look like it's something else? George Harrison was able to document the creative process. This was after he had been a Beatle, so he was like the most important person in the world, or one of four, at the time. And he could document how it was created. He had Billy Preston there, who was played some of the brass on it, who said, I was there. We came up with this little, or George tricked out these couple of notes on his guitar. We smoked a little more stuff. And then we worked on this little riff. And then we put this together. And then the yoga came through, and we talked to the yogi about some stuff. And then we smoked a little more stuff. And then we started singing these words to it. But you had, and Billy Preston was a very well-respected musician. So, and him and a couple of other studio musicians all could say, we were there at the creation. No one said, hey, have you heard this bebop bubblegum song by the Chiffons that was really hot a couple years ago? Let's steal that. And they could tell you how the notes, you know, when they came out of George Harrison's head, they were there. It was independent creation with witnesses. He lost the lawsuit anyway, because it just sounded too much alike. So it was, even though he sort of independently created it, and since he had been a Beatle fairly recently, no one could say he lied, because, you know, it's like saying God lied. You can't do that. He was a Beatle, for God's sake. So they couldn't say he was lying, nor could they say that all the other professional musicians were lying, because they had all been there and watched it. But they said that subconsciously, he had heard the Chiffons song. It lodged in his soft gray matter, and it came back out, although he did not intentionally steal it. Great. And because the Chiffon song was popular, everyone had heard it. And they said, yeah, you're in the music industry. It was a top 40 hit for some time. We know you heard the song. We know you didn't listen to it long. It's a fairly annoying little song. But we know you heard it, George. And you were subconsciously affected by it, and you reproduced it, albeit unintentionally. Oh. So independent creation is going to be kind of hard to prove if the thing that you either infringe or they say you infringe is famous. There was a similar case where it was not George Harrison, but it was someone else who claimed that Cole Porter stole one of his songs. And if you individually looked at the two songs, there were, in fact, some basic similarities. There were similarities not quite as striking as the ones between the Chiffon song and the George Harrison song, but if you, with both the Chiffon song case and this Cole Porter case, if you're actually a musician, you would know that the comparisons between the two were basic music stuff, not really difficult, not really the creative part that would have been copied. It was basic riffs. But the Cole Porter guy, in this case, the work that was claiming to be the infringing work was Cole Porter, but instead of the original work in the case being the Chiffons, who had lawyers and recording studios and stuff behind them and a top 40 hit, it was some guy who played bar mitzvahs in Chicago. He could prove that at least 30 people had heard his song, none of whom were Cole Porter. And so the Cole Porter song survived that one. So sometimes it's a matter of how famous is the original work and how well you can analyze what the underlying basic themes are. Underlying basic themes are not protected. So young boy tragically loses family under circumstances he doesn't quite understand, discovers that he has innate powers to do stuff, learns how to channel them somewhat, is not fully educated in using those powers when he confronts the evil that killed his parents. What am I describing?
Star Wars.
Star Wars. Star Wars.
Harry Potter and Star Wars. My mom saw Star Wars, the movie, and she read Harry Potter. That is pretty much her complete exposure to science fiction and fantasy. That's it. Those are the two she's read. Well, saw one, read one. She's like, when she read Harry Potter, her first comment was, this is the same thing as that movie. Even the name, Darth Vader, what's that name of the Harry Potter book? Starts with some V, Voldemort or something. It's the same name. I hadn't even thought of it. God, they're both the same bad guys, big, tall, black, cape, Voldemort, you know, Vader. Wow.
And, you know, I read Harry Potter. It wasn't a movie at that point. I'd seen Star Wars. They didn't seem even remotely similar to me because they're not. What's similar in them is the basic thing that I just sketched out for you. There are 100 other books with that same plot line. Not all of them involve kissing your sister. But they're all the same story, but we all have been exposed to those movies and those books and hundreds of others like them. And so, did any of y'all, when you read Harry Potter the first time, think, God, this is just like Star Wars? No, because it's not just like Star Wars. But when I described that plot line to you, half of you said Harry Potter, half of you said Star Wars. So obviously it has a lot of the same fundamental parts of it, but that's okay. Is there any reason to think that Harry Potter is a copyright infringement of Star Wars? Of course not. First off, I doubt that she stole from Star Wars. Do you think that J.K. Rowling saw Star Wars? Hell yes, everyone's seen Star Wars. My mom saw Star Wars. We know she saw Star Wars. So if she had if her book had reflected pieces of Star Wars that were protected, even if she thought she independently created it under the George Harrison rules, she would have been found to be violating the Star Wars copyright. I don't think Lucas sued her, because all of us understood in it instantly, well, of course not. Yeah, those similarities are there, but they're the basic ones. We can draw that out of hell. Some of the Robert Jordan books start that way. Prince Caspian is the same story. Yeah, we have a lot of the same storylines in our genres. And we know the difference. My mom didn't, because she only been exposed to two of them. And so all she saw were the similarities. That's one of the reasons you get strange rulings in copyright law, because the judge may not know our genre either. If my grandmother were asked to listen to the guys, the weird guy from Chicago bar mitzvah scene that had written a song and the Cole Porter song, she could probably tell you, if you turned it up loud enough so she could hear it, exactly why those two are very different. If you asked her to tell the difference between really hardcore gangster rap and like Will Smith, parents just don't understand phase of rap, she wouldn't be able to tell the difference because to her that would all be noise. Yeah?
So if George Harrison had brought in other examples that were basically the same as the two songs in question, that might be
different. His lawyers did a fairly good job, and the decision is fairly well written. I usually disagree with the result, but that's more because I really like George Harrison, so I don't think I count as objective by any stretch. But he did a fairly good job defending it, and it's just one of those where it comes down to the judge listens to the two and to his best educated ear does what he can. Sometimes it's a jury case, and it's the same thing. A jury of your peers, we know how all that works out anyway. If it's a jury of my mother, you know, George Lucas could have sued J.K. Rowling for copyright infringement. If it was a jury of you, yeah, not so much. So copyright, like other things, what you're talking about is a little bit specialized, and how close is too close, even like I said, if I hated you, I'd give you all the legal words that describe how close is too close. The bottom line is smell test. But the themes are not protected. The ideas are not protected. So if someone steals your idea, yes, sorry, they can have it. And if someone steals your idea before you write it down, oh, yeah, you got nothing. Yeah.
Could you say something about the point at which a work becomes copyrighted?
As soon as you write it down.
Someone can't copy an article about this session that I publish, but what about copying my notes right now?
Your notes are copyrighted. My speech, oh wait, you're recording me, aren't you, Scott? Ha! My speech is copyrighted. Normally, it's not. Usually I do have notes. I have very little notes for this one.
Wait a minute. He's recording, so your speech is copyrighted, but she's writing down your speech. Are her notes copyrighted even though they're exactly what you said?
Are your notes exactly what I said?
Well,
are they the concept of what I said?
No, but if I wrote down exactly what she said, I'd attribute them to her.
Okay, attribution is not related to copyright. There are exceptions for journalists, but if you copy someone's stuff and then say, oh, by the way, it's someone's stuff, you're still violating their copyright. Plagiarism and infringement are completely different. Plagiarism makes law school professors and undergraduate professors, pretty much any professor, want to flunk you. That's when you steal someone's stuff and you don't say what it is. I wrote this, signed me. I stole this from the internet, please don't Google it. That's plagiarism. It may also be copyright infringement. But plagiarism is passing off someone's other work as your own, usually a big problem in the academic field, sporadically in the political field.
copyright infringement is if you use something that I have the right to keep you from using, even if you say it's mine, you give me full attribution, doesn't matter. I still have the right to shut you down and tell you not to use it. Different things. Now, since Scott is recording this with my permission, that it's fixed. That my speech here is fixed in tangible medium, whatever you're recording it in. I assume there's not something as passe as tape. But even weird digital stuff that lawyers don't normally understand counts as a fixed medium. So because Scott is recording my speech is covered by federal copyright. As this stuff is coming out of my mouth, it's being recorded, it is therefore copyrighted material.
So if I was writing down your exact words right now, I would be
infringing my copyright.
How about that?
She's writing down the gist of what I'm saying. I know she's not writing down every word because her hands aren't bleeding as she's trying to keep up. So she's writing down the gist of what I'm saying. There are also certain carve-outs in the copyright law for reporting and critique. So she could say that, God, this chick is a bimbo. She doesn't know what she's talking about. But I will find out where you live. So she can use short quotes from my speech to show just what an idiot I am. Or better yet, how brilliant and persuasive and eloquent I am. That would be what you should write down. But if she's pulling pieces of copyright law out of my speech, those are hers. She can have them. The facts of what I'm saying are not mine. My expression, which I don't think you would want necessarily to steal, is mine. The stuff I'm telling you that's true, which is all of it, I'm not making any of this up, any of you can have that. Yeah.
Speaking of rebroadcast, are you familiar with Hulu?
Hulu,
it's a website where you can watch old television shows.
Oh, okay.
Put advertising on it. I'm familiar with compulsory license to distribute for sound. Is there some type of compulsory license to distribute for that, or think everything is a personal agreement?
It's either licensed or the copyrights have fallen out. They may be public domain, they may be licensed, or they may be pirates, and they'll be shut down soon.
You can go in and watch, they sell advertising. Buys into. I mean, it's obviously something. There's a legal, legitimate purpose to this site, but I didn't know if there was a compulsory license.
No, there's no compulsory license attached to that. But obviously, some folks are letting them do it because it's one of three things. It's either stuff in the public domain, it's licensed legally, or it's pirates. But McDonald's lawyers usually vet stuff out. That's one way to often see if something's pirated or not. Look, see who's paying for the advertising. If it's some guy selling you research papers as opposed to McDonald's, you know it's probably legitimate. So I'm not familiar with that site exactly, but I would bet that, yeah, it's all licensed. Hang on, you had that.
Hulu's not all old stuff, though. You can watch last night's Daily Show.
And Daily Show has been suing some folks. So okay. some of those have been doing that because YouTube has just screwed up everything. And so a lot of the networks and a lot of the shows are suing YouTube and making them pull that stuff down. Because it was, as soon as it went, someone TiVo'd it and posted, I thought this Stephen Colbert show was great, so I'm going to put it on my YouTube.
Yeah.
Come on, guys. He's making a living here. Cut him some slack. And the networks have been making him pull that crap down. And YouTube has gotten a little better because their lawyers got really tired of saying, yes, pull it down. You can't do that. So YouTube has gotten better at sort of policing it. But how much can you police the whole crap that's out there? You had a question.
I think Hulu is actually run by the networks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they have agreements.
There you go.
Okay. Hulu's legal.
Yeah, but going back, you said she could quote from your speech. If it was a short quote, how short are we talking?
There lines and lines of cases. The answer is it depends, which is the world's favorite legal answer. It depends. In this case, it would be, the rule of thumb is basically, she could quote something I said to give a flavor for my speech. She could quote something I said if how I said it was important. She could quote something I said to make sure she got it exactly right. She couldn't quote big enough chunks that it stole the heart of my speech and it took away the commercial value. Gerald Ford wrote a book, a very long book of his memoirs. Okay, if you were the public in 1978, I think, when this book came out, what do you want to read in Gerald Ford's book? What chapter are you interested in?
Watergate.
That's all you care about. You want to know about Nixon, what did Ford know, what is he ratting out, and how the whole pardon come about. That's all you care about. One of the adult magazines, and I forget which one, it was horrible. It must have been Penthouse or Playboy. One of those magazines, anyway, excerpted from it. They got an advanced copy. They also broke into his office a la Watergate and got the advanced copy. But aside from the whole, no, you can't do that part of it, the other part was, okay, out of a big book, they stole a little amount. But they sold the only part that anyone cared about, and they published it before his book came out. So everyone bought the magazine, because it also had pictures of naked women in it, read the part about Ford that they cared about, and didn't buy his book. So said his lawyers, and frankly, I think that's true. His book would have sold a lot better if the good part hadn't already been published. Now, the rest of what he said was probably interesting, too. I haven't read it. But I'm sure it was also very interesting if you're interested in Gerald Ford. However, everyone in the country was interested in Watergate. And so they sold that part of it. So even though proportionately, it really was not much more than if she wrote down three sentences of mine and published that, she can write down three sentences of mine. Because I don't think there are any three sentences that actually capture the heart and commercial essence of my speech. But they did that to Ford. You can't do that. And some of it has to do with timing. After the book is out, you can probably excerpt more freely. Because he's already had his chance to get the surprise, the sales, and that sort of thing. Then you can excerpt a little more. So you're noticing a lack of hard and fast rules here. You don't know it's infringement until the judge says so. And before a judge says something, lots of lawyers have taken a lot of your money. So infringement, it's in the eye of the beholder. But you can't take too much. And really, too much is the rule. Don't take too much of my speech or you're infringing it. Well, or ask me, and I'll say, yeah, sure, go ahead. Just get my name right and give them an email for me, so if they want to hire me, they can do that, and everything will be fine. So, you know, there's rules of thumb on that level. Does that answer what you were asking?
Yes.
I sometimes get farther afield, like, okay, did I just answer my own question or yours? Okay, you have a question.
Okay, you say that as soon as you write something down, it's yours. How do you document that? I had a friend of a friend say that he mailed the manuscript to himself.
People do that all the time. Don't bother.
Okay. Well, how do you document
that?
You can't. The mailing it to yourself is cute, and if you actually ended up in front of a judge with that unopened envelope to prove that you wrote that manuscript before anyone else did, okay, I guess there's some value to he can then open the envelope and see your manuscript inside. You can do that, but from a and legally there's no reason not to. From a practical standpoint, it's just not going to matter. You're going to say, when did you write it? You're going to have notes of when your creation was, if it's a long novel or something like that, because you're talking manuscripts, it took you a while to write it. You know, you'll be able to have your mother come in and say, you know, I'm upstairs writing this thing, and what year was it that you were doing that? And so it'll be anecdotal evidence like that. What can you do to prove what you were doing? If you keep notes of when you were, if you keep timesheets, those come in. Now, obviously, any of those can be faked. Would your mother lie? Well, that depends on who your mother is. So there are lots of, it'll be cumulative like that. What can you do to prove when you were creating this thing? Did you publish it? If you want to protect your work, don't mail it to yourself. Mail it to the copyright office. Actually file the copyright. That's the next thing. Your copyright is, your work is protected as soon as you fix it in a tangible medium. Your work is better protected if you go ahead and register it. Registration used to be necessary. If you did not register it and jump through a lot of hoops, including the little C with the circle and the correct stuff after that, your work would fall into public domain instantly. If you screwed up anything on the distribution, and often it was the people who were publishing the collective works, it was the book of poetry that forgot to register something correctly, and all the authors lost their stuff. It was the anthologies that forgot to register something correctly, and all the authors lost their stuff. The rules are very draconian. They are written by lawyers for lawyers, and we enjoyed them, and everyone else hated them, and lots of artists lost their rights as a result. That's no longer the law. As soon as you write it down, it's copyrighted. You do not have to register it. You do not have to put the little C with the circle. You don't have to stand on one foot every third noon and say, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine. But if you'll go ahead and register with the Copyright Office, which is easy. Remember I told you, you can't register a patent by yourself. You can register a trademark if you need a couple beers. Copyright's easy. Go online, there's a form, you write your name, the name of your work, your phone number, and you're done. And you send a copy of your work to the Library of Congress. That's one of the things that's always been part of the copyright registration process. Every copyrighted work is supposed to have a copy sent to the Library of Congress. Well, at the Library of Congress, got all their good books. People sent them to them, so they'd be copyrighted. Library of Congress doesn't have to buy stuff. They get it free. They may not actually keep your manuscript on display in the Library of Congress. I assume that they either just burn them or that there is actually some big, you know, Ark of the Covenant kind of warehouse with all this crap in it.
that our tax dollars are paying to keep heated and cooled. But send it to the Library of Congress, register the trade, register the copyright. Once it's registered, you have more rights into your, you have better rights to defend them, but it's all trial stuff. But your rights are stronger once it's registered. The registration's easy, the registration's cheap, and you send a copy along, and then you have documented copies there. That's the best way to do it. Chances are you'll never get through a copyright suit anyway. So, you know, mailing it to yourself, that's cute. It's like one of those wives' tales about putting butter on a burn. You know, it might be better than nothing, but use Neosporin. So, you know, don't mail it to yourself. Register the copyright.
How much does that cost?
$40. It's cheap. I forget the actual fees. It changes sporadically, but it's a cheap one. Copyright's really cheap. Trademark's about $350, and patents are thousands and thousands of dollars. Yeah.
Oh, I have a question. Like, I have, you know, novels and a couple of screenplays that are in the work now. With the, what is it, the East Coast Writers, or there's like a Writers Guild that you can be a member with, and they have, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like a registration where you can actually register works in progress. And
right, and that gives, and that's a nice third-party group that's giving you some way to prove, look, I wrote this at this time. And that's an effective way, because there's no official legal thing you're supposed to do, aside from, you know, register the damn thing. But if you haven't finished it yet, you can't register it yet. So when, to the extent you have a guild like that, that's an excellent way that if it ever came to it, which is very unlikely, but if it came to it, you could get to the, hey, I had this external proof from this group who doesn't care, saying I wrote this on this day. And the judge will go, no, I believe that.
Yeah.
And they'll check and say, wait, who runs this group? Is that your sister? No, it's some people that you're not related to. Yeah, sure, okay, we believe that. We believe you wrote it on this day. And then you're past that element of proof,
again,
and then you go on to the next 18 issues in the case.
Yeah, because they actually have you send a copy so that they have it.
Yeah.
And they send you a certificate that says, you know, this work, was, and it doesn't have to be the final name of your book.
Right, and that's a great thing, and that's a great way to do it. I said, from a practical standpoint, just because copyright suits are really, really expensive. And unless you have a publishing company who's going to be hiring the lawyers, you can't afford it. But that's a good way to do it, so you can at least say, hey, I have this. And it gives you the peace of mind, and it gives you, without going all the way to trial, a way to say, dude, I wrote this. But again, remember, if someone else is writing a very similar work, unless they saw yours and stole it, they're allowed to write that very similar work. That's why most copyright suits don't find infringement, because, yeah, my book's just like yours, but yours wasn't published yet. How would I have ever seen your work? I didn't see your work, I just wrote something similar. Yes, your picture of, I have lots of, when I'm here at Dragon Con, someone always stops me in the hall with their artwork that they've done, that they saw one just like in the dealer's room, and they know that they stole their idea. And I'm like, you know, it's a really pretty picture of a fairy. And I wish I had that kind of artistic talent, but the idea of a really pretty fairy on a tree isn't that original. I'm betting the artist in the dealer's room came up with that by themselves, and yeah, they look really alike, but no. No, I'm not going to go suddenly represent you and take out the artist in the dealer's room, because it's a fairy on a tree. You know, I'm sorry, it's really pretty, but I know that you're bleeding because it's your work and you think that it's the same, but sorry, there's no legal recourse on that one. Yeah.
What about, and I may have missed it because I came in a little later, but what
shame
about,
on you.
What about logos, brand mark, like
trademarks,
slogans, or anything like that?
Trademarks. Register the trademark.
Okay.
We covered that the first 15 minutes of class.
Yeah.
But the answer is that's a trademark. And if you have a specific question, I'll hang out afterwards a bit and I'll answer what it is, but I'm not going to make them listen to the whole thing again. Yeah.
What was the thinking? You like,
oh,
Harry
Potter, you say,
right?
Thinking. And
well,
the answer is probably there wasn't any, but go ahead.
Harry Potter's author, J.K. Rowling, just sued a guy who was doing an encyclopedia or something.
Right.
What was the plan? I mean, where did they... Because it sounds like it's totally ludicrous.
Ludicrous? Which way?
Well, it doesn't sound like she had any basis for what...
Sure, she did.
She
absolutely did. She had every right to sue him, and her case, if it has it been... Is it still an appeal? I haven't heard how it... She will win that case. No question I'm on. That was infringement. If he had written a book about how she wrote the book, Yeah, or something like that. Those are facts. Those are fine. But all the stuff that she made up, the details of her story, the names of the people, the characters, the relationship, all of that really cool, deep detail, which makes all of us read it, although it's targeted people like a third of our age, and we still read all of those books, and we like them. And the reason we like them is because she does a brilliant job of really weaving thick detail. The characters are real. We feel like we know those people. That's why everyone got so pissed or really happy, depending on their bent, when she said that, wait, Dumbledore was gay and had a relationship with Snape, I think was the thing she came up with. And everyone's like, wait, that one in the book. She's like, yes, but it's part of my backstory. I got pissed because they already had images in their mind of those two people and those two relationships. And she wouldn't allow to later come up with another shit and put it in there. Well, yes, she was. It's her world. She made it. She gets to change it. But people were upset by that or surprised by that or said, ha, I knew it, depending on what they had thought all along. But it's because they had opinions about those characters. Those characters are real. She wrote a very good, very detailed, very depth, great embroidery of stuff kind of book. Those details are her expression. Those are the exact thing that are protected. Her characters, her plot lines, the details of it. The basic Star Wars, Harry Potter, coming of age, God, what's the one that the pig king, the pig boy who became king, a Lloyd Alexander book, I think it was. They're all the same plot line. And three of you in this room are writing one with that same plot line. And that's fine. You're not stealing from them, but don't call your bad guy Voldemort and don't send the kid to a Wizards Academy. It starts with an H. But the details of her book are exactly what she owns. Those are that's her expression of the coming of age, discovering magic, taking on evil storyline. And so this kid who wrote the encyclopedia was taking her original stuff. That was the stuff she made up, not the stuff that eight other people have done before her, hundreds of people have done it before her. Hell, when Tolkien did it, it wasn't original. So that stuff he can't take because it's not facts. Had she discovered King Arthur, he could have taken all the details of that. She made up a very detailed story. He took those very details and repackaged them. He made a derivative work of her original works. That's one of the protected rights. You can't do that. If she had come up with a story that was a historical fiction that really was based on Henry VIII and stuff that really happened, then sure, you could take an encyclopedia, base it on her source and her what she says, but not her original made-up stuff. And her whole book is original made-up. The details of her book are what are protected. The kid has no right to do that. Fan fiction is another issue. Am I allowed to write a story about my favorite SG-1 guys? Am I allowed to write the story of how Colonel O'Neill and Samantha Carter got together? Can I write that story? Legally, no. Should I write that story? Probably not.
Yes.
But you have a right to write that story.
I have no right to write that story. Paramount, or whoever owns Stargate 1, has the right to write that story. Most studios, most authors kind of do this about fan fiction because most of them have figured out that fans are actually the ones who are watching their TV shows, seeing their movies, reading their books. And if you piss the fans off, oh wait, that was my customer. Oopsie. So you don't want to piss the fans off, but when the fans start competing with you, like this kid was doing with his encyclopedia, check me the money, the kid was competing with her and she or her publisher might well have wanted to publish the Harry Potter encyclopedia down the road. This kid was doing it. He didn't get to do it. Can he write a really bad piece about Hermione and Wesley getting together and doing whatever they're going to do? Yeah, he could do that. Do they have the right to stop him? Absolutely. Will they? Probably not. Just like the SG-1 guys probably wouldn't come to me and tell me I've got to quit writing my little story about Colonel O'Neill and Samantha Carter. But for taste's sake, they probably wish I wouldn't write it. But would they make me stop? Probably not. If I published the SG-1 compendium, they'd stop me.
So that's why she wouldn't go after like the Wikipedia or a fan site, because they're not making any money on that. There's no money in it.
Wikipedia is different, but that's why most of them don't go after fan sites. They can. You can shut down a fan site. You can shut down the fan art. You can walk through the dealer's room and say, no, 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 no. Take that crap down. It's a violation of my copyright. But most people don't, partially because it costs a lot to send your lawyers to all of these bloody cons and chase all these people down. Partially it does no harm, partially it does some good. Every rabid fan who's out there that's breeding more rabid fans are buying your book. Yeah.
I guess I got a two-part kind of along those lines. Publishers like Dover Press print out of print books and old textbooks, and you can buy public domain
right
from many years ago. Is there a distinct difference between fictional creation and, say, the straight, like, non-fiction work?
Yes.
They go out of date at different times?
If it's, no, there's no distinction in the length of the copyright. The copyright applies to the book no matter what kind of book it is. But even while it is under copyright, your facts are not protected. If you write a textbook, the stuff in your textbook, assuming it's correct and real, the facts in the textbook are not protected. How you expressed it, how you organized it, how you compiled it, the facts you chose, the selection and organization and writing process, you will own all of that. The actual facts in it, no, I can use those facts.
So,
but there's no length and duration. The duration of copyright is the same.
So it's the same thing for like 75
years? Yeah, except the old ones that are currently in the public domain is under the earlier schema, which was two.
And then the other part of the question is, what's the nature of that now? It seems like every couple of years they just decide to extend it. Like there's not going to be an end to the ones that have it.
That could be a whole different session. It's a big chunk of Lessig's book. The answer is, although this is where I was holding stuff as my somewhat useful prop earlier. Lawrence Lessig is a big copyright guy, big free use kind of guy. Creative Commons is actually a really cool project, but he has this huge, like, religious problem with extending copyright terms. The copyright term is fixed in the Constitution as limited. Well, okay, life plus 70 is limited. He's Lessig and a bunch of others, most of whom wanted things to fall in the public domain sooner, got their knickers in a wad because they wanted things to fall in public domain sooner. People who own the stuff would prefer to hold on to their rights longer. So whether you kind of, whether you view yourself as someone who wants to steal stuff from someone else and wants it to be available legally sooner, then you kind of think that they shouldn't have extended the copyright term. If you want to own stuff that you wrote and would like to own it for longer and think that you're going to be wealthy doing this and want your children to own your work longer, keeping in mind one of the reasons that it gets extended, aside from the lobbies and the money, is that most artists don't make any money until after they're dead. You know, kind of a cliche, but also, oh, by the way, true. So one of the reasons that, and I won't bore you with the details, but one of the reasons the original copyright stuff was set up the way it was to keep the dead artist's widow from losing all the money. Because there was often the guy who dies, becomes famous 10 years later, and his widow, who is still starving, who now should have the money, is getting none because they had ways to fix that. Very paternalistic, but fairly effective, and I thought a nice way to go about it. Same thing with length of copyright. If you identify with the folks who own copyrights, you think that letting the kids benefit from it for 50 or 70 years is a good thing. If you kind of align yourself with folks who want to get everything now and be able to, well, I can get all of their facts and all of their ideas. Well, can't I get their exact expression? So I want to be able to write a book with his characters sooner. Why do I have some God-given right to steal his characters and write my own book? I don't think I do. You can guess which side I am on this particular issue. So there's a big hoo-ha over that, but the copyright extension correctly was upheld. Yeah?
I have two questions. First one was, do you lose a copyright if you don't defend it?
No.
So people not shutting down websites,
it's not a use or lose kind of right. Trademark is a use or lose kind of right. If you let people dilute your trademark, you lose your strength in your trademark. And we were talking about that with Coke and the refrigerator and that kind of stuff. But copyright is not that way. If you let a billion people use your copyright, it doesn't keep you from stomping on the billion first person. Second question, sir.
Yeah, have you heard of a case where somebody has used copyright to take something that was in the public domain and bring it back into,
lots of people try to do that. The law is set up so that you can't. Every now and again, someone comes with a clever way they think they can do it. The question was whether you can take something out of the public domain and resubject it to copyright by changing something. The basic law is, if I take a work that's out of public domain, if I took Romeo and Juliet, for instance, and I were to, hypothetically, turn it into a musical set in New York City between two warring gangs of New Yorkers and Puerto Ricans, if I were to hypothetically do that, I still wouldn't own any of Shakespeare's language. Oh, gosh, another show up on stage. But I wouldn't own any of the original stuff from the original work. All I would own was what I added to it. So nothing that was original in the public domain comes out of the public domain because of my reworking of it. Only my additions to it belong to me. Am I way over time, Scott, or do I have a minute more?
2 minutes.
Okay. You had a question. I'm sorry, did I finish yours?
Yes, okay.
Okay.
What about things like parodies, and at what point does something become public domain?
Okay, parody and public domain are unrelated. You have an express right to use someone's copyrighted work in a reporting and critique. I lost my reporter. Reporting and critique is one of the exclusive fair use rights. Parody is another express fair use right. There is a recent case that sucks that is a fair use case about parody. It was by someone in the earlier panel, or yesterday's panel mentioned Joe Beck, lawyer downtown, and he is really a good lawyer. And he convinced them that that horrible Gone with the Wind knockoff was a parody. Have any of y'all been forced to read that in a lit class? It's just drivel. And it's not a parody by any stretch of the imagination. He got some academics, and if you live in the ivory tower long enough, you lose touch with the mothership. And there's this whole line in literary studies where they convince themselves that parodies don't have to be funny, which is good, because it wasn't funny at all. She just basically stole the characters from Gone with the Wind and wrote her own book with them. Gone with the Wind is still under copyright, and the heirs said, you can't do that. And bless his heart, Joe Beck convinced the judge that, yeah, you can, but that was a parody somehow. It wasn't. It was also badly written. But so that became a parody. So the parody right has now been expanded because of that really bad case. It will hopefully contract back to something more reasonable. Saturday Night Live, that's a parody. Y'all know what that is. The stuff on Dragon Con TV, that's parody. We all know what parody is. It was not The Wind Does Blown. That was a ripoff. And she won the case anyway. So parody currently is a bad example. But yes, you have a right to do a parody. It's limited. And it has nothing to do with when it falls into public domain. Doing a parody of something does not put the underlying work into public domain. When it falls in public domain has to do with when the copyright expires. I think, yes.
What about hip-hop?
What about hip-hop?
Well, I'm taking a couple records that I didn't write, and I'm spinning them, and I'm mashing them together in order to create...
You're creating a derivative work, and you are violating the copyright in those underlying works.
So you think that hip-hop should essentially be illegal unless it's cleared?
Hip-hop is illegal unless it's licensed. It's usually not enforced. Vanilla Ice discovered that sometimes it is. I know he's not technically hip-hop.
Well, it's not illegal if the items that are being spun are in public domain.
Of course not. Items in the public domain are not covered by copyright. You cannot infringe a copyright by using a public domain work. No matter what you do to someone's underlying protected work, if you mash it together with a different one and, you know, turn it into Ice Ice Baby, you're still stealing the riff from Queen. I forget which was the first of those sampling cases. The Kate Bush sample, I think, that one of the Outcasts or some of the original groups put into their song. And they discovered that even though people in hip-hop clubs have been doing that for years, you better not do that without permission if you're going to actually record it and sell it. Because, yes, if you sample or if you mash two works together, that's creating derivative work. If those works are protected by copyright, you have created a derivative work and you are violating copyright. Will they stop you? Yeah, probably not. If you get a if the ASCAP guys hear you doing it, they might stop you. And if you try to record it and sell it, whoever owns those works will probably come after you at that point. So I don't think hip-hop should be illegal, but it is, at least that aspect of it.
What about contracting public use, like Michael Jackson buying the Beatles?
Those are the rights, and he bought them.
Reduces the amount of time, or
No, it doesn't extend it at all. When Michael Jackson bought the Beatles library, aside from that being somewhat sacrilegious and blasphemous on many levels, from a legal standpoint, whoever was selling the Beatles' works, and it wasn't the Beatles anymore, one of their studios owned it. So whoever owned the Beatles' works had gotten those rights from the Beatles. The quick analogy is a bundle of sticks. If I create something, I own a bundle of rights. I have the right to reproduce, the right to sell, the right to derive new works, the right to do several other things too. Performance is one of them. I have those rights. I can give each of you a part of my rights. I can divvy it up in lots of ways. I can't give you more than I have. If I give him the exclusive right to turn my speech into a primetime movie, I can't give that right to someone else I don't have anymore. So the Beatles at some point gave their rights and their music to some version of some corporate entities who sold them back and forth, and those rights are what Michael Jackson bought. It's just a good on the market, and he bought the remaining rights to the Beatles songs. His purchase did not extend those rights in any way. They still expire the same day they would have if John, Paul, George, and Ringo still owned them. So it wasn't a matter of extending them in any way. It's just a matter of who was profiting from them.
Is it 50 years after it becomes fair use?
Theirs was different. The Beatles were both under British law, not American, and were in the previous schema, and I have to confess, I have no idea what the term of copyright was in the 1960s in England. Here it would have been a two-term thing that would have had to renew, and it would have been 15 years, then 17, then 40, but it's I don't know the answer for 1960s England. But whatever it was, it didn't get any longer when Michael Jackson bought it. And I suspect that I am done. More than, he says, please stop talking. Okay. Again, thank you for coming out and listening. I will leave the room so Scott doesn't hurt me. If you had a question that I didn't get to, I can hang out for a few minutes and answer them. But I'll go before he starts throwing pointy things at me. Thank you very much.